It's January 2009, and this is the Mac Developer Roundtable, episode 15. Well, welcome to another episode of the Mac Developer Roundtable, and what a roundtable we have for you tonight. The quality of the people around this table is as high as it could possibly be, I think. Anyway, we'll let you decide that for yourselves. Let's start with a few highs. Colin Wheeler, how are you doing, Colin?
I'm doing great, Scotty. I'm Colin Wheeler. I run CocoSamurai.com. I just supposedly finished school here. Waiting to get that confirmation, but basically I'm working on a few projects here, and mainly since I've been done with school, I've been researching how to use dtrace with Coco, and that's been consuming the majority of my time outside of my Coco projects I'm working on that I'm not quite ready to reveal yet.
Okay, great. That sounds like a definitely future late night Coco guest just warming himself up there. Next, roundtable, old hand now. Danny Gregg, how are you doing, Danny?
Not too bad, Scotty. You put me on a bit of a pedestal there. Hi, I'm Danny Gregg, and I work full-time developing Coco applications for Real Mac Software down in Brighton, Sussex, UK.
Great. Good to have you back, Danny. And next, Justin Miller. How are you doing, Justin?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on again.
It's great to have you here. Just remind us who you are.
Sure. I'm Justin Miller. This is my second time on the roundtable. I'm currently in Portland, Oregon, and I run a shop called Code Sorcery Workshop, where I have a couple products, and I do some freelance work, both in Coco and some other things, other technologies like PHP, Drupal, some systems administration.
Great. Looking forward to what you have to say this evening. Next, Mac Developer Roundtable new boy, Mitch Cohen. How are you doing, Mitch?
Good, Scotty. Thank you. My name is Mitch Cohen, and I am the newbie both to this podcast and to some extent to Mac development, although I've been doing it off and on since around 86. I should say that my glass of water near here is sitting on my old but original ThinkC user manual, which I pulled out just for this occasion. I make my living as a Mac IT and web developer under the company name Proactive Interactive. I've been doing some Mac contract programming off and on for many years, some freeware and some shareware, but I've never released anything truly commercial. And for better or worse, I should admit that I'm a part-time politician for whatever that may cause in discussion.
Well, that just basically means you'll never answer any of the questions, doesn't it?
I guess I'm a professional question avoider, but I'm here to learn as well as to help where little I can do that.
Great. Well, it's good to have you here, Mitch. And last, but no means least, Mac legend and party animal, Brent Simmons.
Well, that's a very nice introduction. My name is Brent Simmons. I write NetNewsWire. I work for a company called NewsGator. I've been doing Mac development since the mid-90s or so. I worked for Userland Software for many years. I got my start on Apple II Plus way back in 1980. So I've been in Apple programmer guy for a long time, longer than some of the guests have been alive, apparently.
Yep.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's not longer than I've been alive, as much as I would like it to be. Well, it's great to have everyone on, and our subject for this roundtable is Coco, what I need to know and what I don't need to know. We've just been thinking that the Coco libraries and the Coco frameworks, or even some ways defining what Coco is, has become so big that for someone coming to Coco and someone new to Coco, actually deciding where you start and what you need to know and where you should approach it can be quite daunting. So we just thought we'd get a few people of different experience around a virtual table, and we'd have a chat about it. And hopefully out of this chat will come something useful to people. And if not, then, well, hopefully at least there'll be a good joke or two somewhere in there. No pressure on it. Now, Justin, I know you wanted to start us off with a little bit of background. So the floor is now open. Justin kicks off.
I was just wondering what everyone's background was coming into Coco as far as programming environments and languages. Myself, I started in Perl and PHP probably 10 or 12 years ago, and I had never used a debugger before. I had never used an IDE. and I'd never done any kind of desktop work or anything with compiled languages. And so Cocoa was the first one that really clicked with me, and I was just kind of curious what everyone else's backgrounds were and if they knew C or other languages similar to Objective-C before they came into Cocoa.
I'll quickly fill in mine, although it's probably already known. I was a Windows developer before coming to Cocoa. I was mainly spent most of my time in Windows writing in Delphi and Objective Pascal, or C# and .NET. So I had no raw C experience at all, though I did have C-like syntax language under my belt.
Yeah, I basically did a lot of desktop apps. I mean, I sort of learned programming in school. I didn't really learn it that well ahead of time. I was mainly doing web stuff before I went into my programming program in school. And there I sort of learned C, C++, Visual Basic, a lot of the basic stuff. And after that, it was pretty easy for me to pick up Objective-C.
Let's see. I started off with Basic, went to 6502 Assembler, then picked up AppleScript, UserTalk, and C. And in C, I wrote desktop apps on, using the old Macintosh toolbox and also a little bit on Windows. Writing in C and Windows was a terrible experience. I'm glad to have put that far behind me. And I started picking up Cocoa in, 2001, something like that.
Okay, I started when I was still in college when I started wanting to program for the Mac. I got taught real basic, actually, because my IT teacher was a big Mac nut. So I wanted this all working on Macs. And so I started doing stuff in real basic as well as VB and some assembler. And that's what led me on to Cocoa. So I pretty much came straight out of basic.
I've been programming since about forever. My first coding experience wasn't on COBOL, as I saw on the back channel there, was on BASIC on a Commodore PET in, I believe it was 1979. On the Mac, 86, I did some Lightspeed C projects, then ThinkC. I've worked on CodeWarrior, MPW, HyperTalk, and HyperCard, AppleScript, you name it. But I've been more on the web scripting side for the last several years, and I'm trying to get back into this. I would say that I've been using Cocoa for 2 to 3 years, but real work and real life has kept me from spending enough time to spend too much time doing the actual work. So that's about where I am.
Okay, so it sounds like we've come from a sort of a real mix of languages. I'm just trying to think back. Did anyone here actually have lots of C experience? I know Brent said he was doing C on Windows. Anyone else have lots of C experience before coming to Cocoa? Or you know, what was the biggest thing for anyone when they first came to Cocoa? What was the thing that struck them as, oh my word, I don't know what this is? You know, what aspect of it?
A square bracket. I hadn't actually touched C before I started learning Cocoa. So there was lots of crazy stuff around, but square brackets freaked the hell out of me. I did not know what was going on.
Yeah, it's the bracket's a little bit unusual. It's sort of weird when you're coming from like C, C++ to look at it and see that. The other thing is like if you're coming from like C, it feels like this whole, I guess, you know, things with delegates and so forth and these classes working together. It feels like, you know, you're setting up some spectacular laser show and every mirror has to be just in its place and you don't quite get what's doing what. And you have to get over, you know, learn what the classes are doing and sort of get over, you know, learn the behaviors and then you get used to it a little bit.
I've been using C since probably the mid-80s, but as I said, spent many years off of it. When I got back in and wanted to learn Cocoa, the C really wasn't the hard part, but somebody mentioned all the brackets freaked the hell out of me also, until I spent about a weekend with it, and then it makes perfect sense. And the whole paradigm of Objective-C and the way it deals with objects and messaging Anytime I go to any other language now, I wish that I had that capability. So once I spent some time with it, there was really no going back in terms of desire, and I wish I could take it elsewhere.
For me, one of the first things that freaked me out was using an application framework. I was used to having, you know, toolboxes and APIs that I could use. But when you have a framework, it's almost more like the framework uses you. Sounds kind of Soviet, actually. Yes, here in Cocoa Land, frameworks use you. And that's just a very different way of writing an application than what I was used to. But I picked it up, you know, after a little bit, had to wrap my head around it.
For me, for whatever reason, the bracket syntax just really clicked with me. And the other thing that did click, I'll get to the thing that freaked me out in a minute, but the other thing that really did click was actually the memory management part. That's part of why I had always shied away from C. I just felt it was too intimidating to figure out what I should be managing and what goes where. And it really kind of clicked with me in Cocoa. But outside of Objective-C in particular, in Xcode, the thing that really freaked me out off the bat was build settings and targets and all those little build settings you can get together in the get info window. And worrying about touching something or messing something up and breaking it and not being able to figure out what I changed. And in actuality, after some time with it, it wasn't that bad. And I know how to figure out, you know, what I changed and things like that. But there's so much in there and so much that was command line arguments to the compiler and all kinds of stuff like that. So my advice would be, don't worry about it. Just try not to touch anything until you are, you know, you find a tutorial that teaches you how to change something to fix a problem, and you'll be all right. It's not that bad.
I'd just like to elaborate a bit on something Justin said about the reference counting. I totally agree. Coming from a garbage collected basic background, suddenly seeing these errors saying X bad access. I mean, what's going on? I never had a memory management issue before. So suddenly seeing all these bugs logging into the console, or what I have to hit retain, and then what's this release thing do? That was the fact that it introduces a lot more problems to you immediately, and these weird error messages you haven't seen before, that threw me off quite a lot.
Yeah, memory management was something I think it's coming up for quite a few of us. For me, I mean, I'm an old man, unlike Danny, so I had worked with memory managed languages before, where I'd had to, you have to alloc and free. There was no reference counting; it was just pure memory management. But equally, I was coming from a garbage collected environment when I first moved to Cocoa, and the whole concept of having to go back to doing memory management just felt like a real pain in the backside. And then do it and you learn a new one was it was interesting, because, you know, I think some of the concepts such as auto release and that, you know, although you can describe them quite quickly, I think sometimes they take a little while to really sink in and become part of the way you think. And until they do, everything is hard work.
Yeah, I'd mention in particular too, as a general tip, to try to stick to the convenience methods or the class methods of classes. An example being for NSString, stick with something like string with format instead of init with format. So really it's an auto released thing, and you don't have to worry about it. You'll get into situations where you do have to start paying attention to memory management eventually. But if you just kind of focus on using those and don't worry about where the memory goes, you'll be able to get things working and get your code up and running and see things in front of you. And then after that, you can kind of figure out the best way of doing something. But there's nothing wrong with doing it that way. You could just maybe eke out some performance down the road by getting into memory management specifically.
Okay, I mean, we've all brought up memory management as something that we found as an obstacle. Not everyone. Some of us have brought up memory management, some of our obstacle. But yeah, maybe we're just rushing ahead a little bit there. Just a question to everyone here. If you were going back to start learning Cocoa all over again, but knowing what you know now, which I know is a stupid question because you wouldn't need to learn Cocoa, but, you know, bear with me. What would you make sure you learned first this time? Anyone want to pick that one up?
I'd probably like to have a bit more of a read. I rushed through learning Cocoa too much, in my opinion. And I'd quite like to have taken the time to study the whole process of delegation. As I think Colin mentioned previously, I rushed into that completely, and coming from a bit more of a sort of event-driven, but you had things called events in Real Basic, which obviously you don't have in Objective-C in quite the same way. I did not get this process of delegation for a very long time. And all it would have taken is for me to sat down and read the whole principle for me to understand that. So I would like to have read through that much clearer.
I'll jump in. The one thing I really wish I would have learned from the start was how to work the debugger, both in Xcode and then some basic GDB command line stuff, like printing out variables and what their values are. I came from a scripting background, and I'm kind of pretty much self-taught, so I didn't really know about IDEs and debugging and how that worked. And the ability to pause your program anywhere, either by hitting the pause button or setting a breakpoint, and then just look at what's going on, because things go by so fast. To know that I could have done that right from the start, I would have been doing that from day one. So it really makes sense to invest. It doesn't take much time. It's not super complicated, but invest some time up front to figuring out what you can do with a debugger and basically how to put your program on pause and figure out what the heck's going on. It goes a long way towards helping you learn what's going wrong in your code.
I would suggest to anybody that learning C is a very, very good thing to do. It's a powerful tool, and you understand what's going on a whole lot better. But at the same time, I did not learn, at least not well, any object-oriented languages before starting Cocoa. And it might have been a really good idea if I had Ruby or Python under my belt at that time, and kind of wish I had. I knew a little Java, but that was the extent of my object-oriented exposure at that time.
From my experience, really time was the biggest issue. All of us sounds like we've all coded in a variety of languages, and perhaps we've all, at least myself, developed some arrogance that it's just another language, you can pick it up pretty quick. What I found is, until I really sat down and spent, in my case, it was one weekend, just doing almost nothing but, okay, I'm going to write an app, I don't care what it is, that I got over the hurdles and the mysteries that were that made Cocoa different, the brackets, the frameworks, understanding memory management and everything like that. And it was really the commitment to spend some serious time with this as opposed to any specific intricacies with the language.
Yeah, I think for me, I wish I had really spent more time in the documentation. As silly as it sounds, I think it, especially when I was first learning, as like going through the examples, and there are points in the documentation that, you know, they could be better written sometimes, but there are points that, you know, about how everything runs, and you know, when you're trying to learn bindings, you know, finer points about how it operates that that you really should know. And you know, it's something you just need to really go through and take your time and sort of make sure you understand one concept before you sort of just want to plow through and learn, you know, bindings and garbage collection and all that, and like a bunch of things at once.
Yeah, I mean, I found Apple's documentation when I came to Cocoa incredibly frustrating. Apple's docs, I thought, on the whole, are written for people who already know how to do it and are just trying to look up and remind themselves or get the syntax or find out what that parameter was. I found for actually starting and grabbing some of the principles, it was just far too spread out across too many documents. And even the sort of Cocoa beginner's guide, it really, personally, I didn't find it that helpful. Now I go back to the docs and I think, oh, that's quite useful. But I'm thinking that's now because I know more, they're useful. Whereas I remember looking back then and thinking, yeah, well, I wanted to say lots of rude words about Apple.
Yeah, I'll agree with that 100%. They're super useful and indispensable right now. But when I was learning, it really was learning from blog posts people in the community were making, or from printed hardcover books like the Aaron Hillegass book, which is probably the most popular. I did feel like Apple stuff was written. I mean, I started looking at it a couple years into the OS X transition, 2002, 2003, but I still feel like it was written for people coming from OS 9 and prior, or coming from lots of desktop experience already, and it was just kind of a reference, less or more than a how-to. So I second that 100%.
Unfortunately, all I can do is really third the same comment. The Apple seems to have, and maybe it's intentional, a window where it almost seems at times that they don't want the intro developer to get in, perhaps because they only want the best developers to develop Cocoa apps. I'm not quite sure, but the learning process, there was a big gap, especially in the Apple provided content. One of the things I was thinking about before today was before the 2007 WWDC, they had blanking on what the heck it was called, but they had some coding head starts beforehand with some video, and I was all excited because I was thinking, well, gee, this is a good opportunity to get caught up before I go out there, and that was my first conference. But the video was just somebody talking here and then go read, and perhaps I'm more of a watch somebody who's actually doing as opposed to reading process. But I thought that that Apple, and I still think that Apple, doesn't provide the tools to get really from point A to point C.
Yeah, I think perhaps one of the best advice I can give to people coming to Cocoa for the first time is to find blogs, you know, by people out there who are not just, you know, pointing to the documentation, but they're sort of putting it in a context. They're trying to almost give a personal touch to, you know, here's Binding's work, and really this is what you need to know, and we're going to sort of try and take you through it and give you, you know, there's a lot of information in the documentation, but here, for now, for the time being, here's what's relevant to you. I think anybody coming to Cocoa should really sort of look around and see, find some blog of somebody they like, and just sort of start off that way.
Brent, you said back when we were going to what was on the obstacles for you is you'd done no object-oriented based development at all. Now, obviously, Objective-C and Cocoa is a totally object-oriented way of working. So how did you get to grips with that? Was that something that just naturally fell into place, or did you get yourself some training? Did you just slog away with it for months until it? Yeah. What sort of process did you have to go through, and how did you find that process?
Let's see. Well, I was writing in C, by and large, had been for a few years, and I had a kind of an aha moment early on. First, I'll describe how we wrote in C. What we often did is, you know, if we had an object, I'm talking about the application Userland Frontier that I was working on. If we had an object, whether it was in, you know, an outline, a database table, or whatever, they were defined as a struct, and every struct would have, you know, a bunch of, you know, different attributes, but they also contained function pointers so that, you know, we could actually have a kind of inheritance. You know, you might have, you know, one outline is treated slightly different than another kind of outline just by overriding some methods. So I was, you know, happily writing C this way and thinking it was wonderful and this is very, very cool. Without really knowing much about object-oriented programming, when I started using Cocoa, I'm like, oh, this! I realized this is exactly like what we were doing, except I don't have to go through all the pain of setting up structures in this way and, you know, using function pointers and all that kind of stuff. It was just a much more obvious and easy and natural way. The second I got that was the second I understood it completely. And I think that was just fortunate that my C experience was object-oriented in nature, even though it wasn't technically an object-oriented language.
That's really quite interesting. It's part of my career in the past. I teach people to program, and often when someone is, you know, coming to a language, whether it was .NET or Delphi, or if it was Cocoa now, you know, I would often start by spending, you know, at least a good few hours going through OOP techniques, OOP terminology, just OOP understanding. Because I found that, you know, that was just such a bottleneck. And I also find, I don't know what people find in the Cocoa world, but in some languages, especially with the modern IDEs. It's not quite so easy to do it this way in interface. We're using Interface Builder and Xcode, but it's still possible. Is lots of people actually write just functional or procedural based code inside a method of what happens to be an object, even though they don't really quite get that concept. So for me, I would say if you don't know OOP, if you're not coming from an object-oriented background, it is worth just, you know, spending a little bit of time trying to get those principles of messaging and of objects and of inheritance and polymorphism. And obviously with Coco, as Danny was saying, the whole way delegates work into your head and understanding that, because it will make a difference to how you end up coding.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had people who have emailed me, you know, asking, you know, what exactly they need to do to learn Coco. And I've underestimated. I know some friends of mine who are in programming, but who are good, decent programmers, but they genuinely don't get the object-oriented design concept. And that's something, you know, when you're, it's amazing that, you know, in retrospect now we're sort of like, you know, it's just, we deal with objects every day and don't really think about it that much. But to somebody who, you know, who doesn't know object-oriented programming, you know, I don't think I really even got, I tried to learn Objective-C a little bit, but it was really only after I sort of learned C++ that I sort of really started getting C, because I'd learned, you know, object-oriented programming in class. And so that's something really key to learning Coco if you don't know object-oriented programming.
Here's another topic I was thinking about just a moment ago. What are some things that you all would recommend somebody start on with their first app, meaning not say their first app for release, but their first actual Coco app that they're going to try to put together and say, I'm learning Coco on this, it runs, I've started to learn Coco. And I'll start off with a couple. I would recommend you stay with kind of a single window application. I mean, again, this depends on your background. If you're an old hand at desktop software, maybe you jump right into document-based applications or full-screen kiosk-style applications or a number of different things. But for me, what was useful is to stick with a single window. You know, the application window comes up to learn how nibs work and how the views that you put into a nib, how they get saved. And then also when you have your own custom objects like your application controller or things like that, how you stick that into a nib and how it appears in your code. Just really understand how that all works. And the other thing, getting really into just a basic bare bones nib right off of off the bat, you can learn how outlets and connections kind of fit together and quickly get over the hurdle of missing a connection or an outlet and wondering why when you click a button it doesn't do anything, because that happens to all of us. You know, years down the road you're still doing that kind of thing, but it can be really frustrating if you've never run into that before and you can't figure out why the heck your button doesn't work. So just start with a basic app. That's my recommendation. Anybody else have any kind of tips?
Yeah, I'll jump in. A lot of great recommendations there. One thing I liked when I was learning is I like to do things with sort of immediate visual impact. I like to know that what I was doing was the right thing and it worked. So I would recommend doing stuff like you spoke about Windows. I would probably like to get in and deal with a bit more loading. You said recommend a single Windows. I'd more go along the lines of learning to deal with multiple nibs maybe, and putting, you know, two windows on the screen. And then sort of just having buttons which press and have something happen visually. So you've got an immediate cue that you know what you did was right and it worked. You'd probably want to cover a few areas of Coco, but you don't want to go too extreme. So obviously use a lot of built-in classes, but don't go crazy. But the main thing, as you were suggesting with the outlets, is to get used to the whole Xcode and IB workflow. And, you know, writing your IB outlets, connecting them up. And yes, you said we all have the hurdle where an IB outlet isn't connected. And the earlier you hit that and get used to solving that problem, the better.
Yeah, that's a good point about multiple nibs. That's something I didn't really learn early on. You put too much into one nib, and down the road, it's something you have to optimize for. So that's a great point to learn how to split out your windows and your preference window and your your utility windows and all that kind of stuff and learn how to load MIBS. Good point.
Yeah, that took me way too long to figure out.
I would just say make the simplest version of some app you actually care about, something that matters to you. I think that's the advice actually in Aaron Hillegass's book, and I ended up making something that I didn't even know, I didn't see there was any app out there. I made Assignment Tracker X, which is really bad by my standards today. It's still in SourceForge now, but basically it was, I made a really simple application that basically kept track of my assignments, and it was really it started out very, very simplistically. Then as macOS 10 evolved and got Cocoa Bindings, I sort of adapted it, and it was sort of an interesting experience, you know, taking this very, very simplistic application that just basically keeps track of a few things and basically adapting it to the new technologies over time. And then you can even open source it if you don't mind doing that and sort of get feedback from other people about what's right and what's wrong about your application. It's sort of a really nice learning experience.
If I were to start learning now, I think what I'd actually want to do is start on the iPhone with something like an iPhone utility app, which forces you to stay simple. You've got a couple of Windows nibs you've got to deal with because you've got the flipping around, but you still have to deal with memory management, and you've got limited framework access. And I think that's a great way to learn, and it forces you to stay simple as opposed to worrying about anything and everything a major app might do.
I would recommend doing something that has to do with the web. You know, we're all spending more and more time on the web or using web services in one way or another, in particular iPhone apps too. It seems that so many of them connect to the web in some way. So it's pretty much a guarantee that you're going to need to know NSURL connection, maybe how to parse XML, JSON, whatever, in the future, almost no matter what you're doing. Even if it's a game and you just want to share high scores, you know, over the web, you're going to need to know this stuff. And frankly, people really enjoy those kinds of applications a ton. So that's what I'd recommend, starting with the web.
Yeah, I mean, I guess here people are getting lots of different options and maybe they'd like one, but you know, there is no one answer. For me, I came from, as I said before, Visual Studio and Delphi environment. And the whole way that Windows and Forms and what we called events connected up and how you handle a button click was really very different. So the first thing I'll do is I would probably do just instead I'd do a single window application, and I would really get to grips with IB Outlet and IB Action. I'd really want to sort of, you know, how they link up, either an interface builder or how you could link them up in code. I'd really get to grips with that, you know, that concept that this is how messages are triggered between your interface, and this is how your controller references your interface, and get that side of things done. Once I've done that, I will probably go along with Danny, and I probably start looking at NS Window Controller. You know, I want to start seeing how I open windows and close windows, how I did memory management for windows, modal, non-modal, all that sort of stuff, because, you know, my application is going to involve opening and closing windows. This is a long answer, I know. Then I would probably look at something like NS Text View, because it's a reasonably chunky control. It's got different actions that you can tap into, or you can override bits of it to make it do certain things. And from that, I would begin to get the concept of how you use controls. And once I got to a little bit of grips with NS Text View, I'd probably move on to the dreaded NS Table View, and using that to get to grips with delegates. Because, you know, just, you know, as Danny said earlier, delegates are a key point. NS Table View is probably a pretty good example of a control that's looking for a delegate and doing all that sort of stuff. And then once I was there, move on to NS Object Controller, get to grips with that. And by the time you'd finished that, I would think I would have a reasonably good overview of many of the aspects that I would expect in a standard, simple Cocoa application.
Politician.
Another way to look at it is everyone learns differently. So it may be a matter of each one of us is right for a certain percentage of folks. I think I'm getting some great ideas from other people how maybe I could have learned back in the beginning, and maybe it wouldn't have worked.
Well, people's needs are going to be different depending on what they want to develop, I guess. I mean, if someone out there is probably going to want to develop tons of command line utilities, but that wasn't me.
Okay, let's take this forward a little bit. I mean, really, what we've been dealing with so far is, you know, what was our first barrier? And that was different for each one of us because we all came from a different place. We've just discussed, you know, where would you start to really just learn Cocoa? And although we had different answers, they all actually were starting fairly simple, and they were all based on getting certain concepts of the way Cocoa, Xcode, and Interface Builder worked. I mean, they, even though there were slightly different approaches, that's what we dealt with. Now, after that, once those basics are down, you know, there becomes the whole aspect that the Cocoa framework is, I think it was Brent who said, you know, the framework drove me. The framework is huge. In fact, you know, there's even debate about what is in the framework, what is in the framework, what is Cocoa. And I guess if you're looking to write an audio application, you might start looking at the audio stuff. If you're trying to, you know, write a you know, something else, you might look at animation. But, you know, once you've got those basics down, you know, there are certain aspects of Cocoa, I guess, that, you know, are needed across lots of applications. You know, where would you begin to learn next? I mean, one of my problems still now is, you know, having done this stuff for a couple of years, is I can spend, you know, a morning writing some code only to the next day discover there was a class that did it for me. So where would you suggest people begin to dig into Cocoa in order to get that broad knowledge, which is going to save them a lot of time in developing an application at the end of the day?
I'll say there's not one place in my book. I think I gain most of my knowledge in segments depending on what I want to develop. If as Brent was saying, if I wanted to develop something which uses a web API, then I'll probably go on some mailing lists or something and look after and see, oh, what should I be using to do a post request? And then that'll come back with a class, say, and then I'll look up the class. So I think it's more compartmental, and you've got to decide what you want to do with Cocoa before you want to start learning. I mean, as you said, it's huge. I don't think there's one place where you can just decide to start learning massive amounts about Cocoa.
Yeah, I think there's really no way around spending the time. If you want the broad general knowledge, you have to spend a lot of time to get there. There's no real shortcut. But that said, you know, when you see something done and you want to do something kind of like it, you know, you can check out that app, try and figure out how it's done, email the developer, read mailing lists, read as many weblogs as possible, find out what people are talking about, what they're using, what they're doing. And that can teach you a ton. I'd recommend using a RSS reader, by the way. It helps.
I just wanted to touch on something Brent mentioned earlier about writing for the web. I mean, that's obviously the direction I went with my first public app, Pukka. And touch on some specifics. I think that's really good for getting into a lot of broad areas. Because just to give you an example, I mean, he mentioned in generalities, fetching from a JSON request or XML and then parsing that. I mean, when you do that, you think about it, you're like, okay, this is probably going to be two lines of code. I fetch the thing, and then I parse the thing, and then I do stuff with it. But when you start getting into that, you realize you've got an NSURL connection, and then, oh, you've probably got credentials involved. So you get into the fun that is the keychain, and then you start dealing with the delegate protocol, the delegate responses on the URL connection, and then you've got an NSURL response, and you have to cast it to an HTTP response to get the status code, and then you've got to look at the error messages, and there's a lot of different stuff you can really... You kind of go down a couple rabbit holes, and none of it's dead-end knowledge, because you're going to find that same kind of pattern and practice in many other parts of the framework. So that's just, another vote for what Brent said, do something with the web. But.
Yeah, I got to say, I think, you know, you got to, assuming you have an idea for an app, you probably know at least one or two technologies that it's using, you know, whether it's bindings, you know, or connecting to the web, like we've been saying here, you know, you're doing something with animation, and probably you got to sort of, you know, pick your fights and sort of maybe like go at the, you know, maybe you want to learn, you have to do something with Quartz, or so you do, you'll start off with like, you know, an S Bezier path using the COCO classes and sort of getting into it easy. Then maybe later on you say, well, no, now I need to, you know, I really need the core graphics, C API, and you sort of need to dig into that. And so it's sort of, I guess, you'll sort of just look around, find the basic example of it, most basic example of it that you can find, and then you sort of branch and dig deep down into whatever you're looking at. And that's sort of how I approach it.
Another thing I would suggest that people did is just go out there and find other people's source code. There's, you know, quite a lot of examples out there, but there's nothing, you know, quite like getting a full application if you can find a reasonable sized application and just seeing what's going on, because often examples and small projects are so contrived that you can't really get the feel for it, where sometimes spending, you know, a day or two in somebody else's source code in a real application, even if it's not the best application ever, because, you know, the reality is a lot of the code you're going to come across is going to be of varying quality, and really just getting a feel for some of the classes, just going through it, you're going to find things like NS number or CG great. Just going through it, you're going to find, you know, people using methods on NS string or NS number that you hadn't necessarily come across yet, and you're going to start looking things up. So really, having a code base to go and look at is a great way of learning as well.
I would suggest too that as soon as you've written that first thing, give back right away. Open source it, put it up on your website or Google Code or wherever, because guaranteed there's going to be someone coming along after you. And, you know, whatever you've done, even if it's very simple, perhaps especially if it's very simple, they're going to find, they're going to learn stuff from it. And you're also going to see other developers pick apart your code a little bit and say, oh, it would be better if you did it like this. And you'll learn something too. So it's valuable all around.
I would perhaps edge more into looking maybe for tutorials rather than diving straight into open source. Open source can be great, but a lot of the time I saw Coco source that was, for want of a better term, basically it made me feel out of my depth. And I didn't really know what the heck was going on in a lot of places, and therefore just confused me if I was trying to do something simple. And now it's great when I understand it all. So I would possibly look at more tutorial-based things, but once you get the grips, I mean, open source can be great.
I would disagree with that a bit. I mean, I learned some things I didn't even know you could do, and like I learned, you know, the pound, pragma, mark, you know, and then, you know, that indicator, you can, so you can label, you know, inside your method pop-up button, you could see, you know, this is, you know, Coco bindings methods, and you learn a lot of things from other people's source code, even if they're source code that's way above your head in terms of your ability to level. You just sort of need to sort of pick apart and, you know, look at and go through something, and if you find something interesting that you, it looks like it, that looks like something you're curious about, then go look it up in the documentation. But you just sort of need, even if you have a vastly complicated source code base, you can sort of pick it apart if you know how to sort of, you know, what to pay attention to, sort of just chop it apart bit by bit, and then only focus on the things that matter to you.
Certainly looking at sample code is a great way to learn. Something else in addition that I've found is when I want to do something, I assume that Apple has already written a framework or some code to allow me to do that, and then I search through the documentation until I find it, and only once I don't find it do I go ahead and try to find some samples elsewhere. The frameworks are incredibly rich, as we all know, and that's just it's all there, and if you find some samples from Apple or just the definition of the framework, half the time, half of what you want to do is already done.
So, Mitch, what sort of process do you go through to try and discover if Apple have already got something in the framework?
Typically a lot of searching. Sometimes it's just, I always start with the documentation, just within Xcode. And then if I don't find it, sometimes I'll find sample code that does what I want, and I'll just look for one tiny little snippet. And instead of trying to dissect how someone else thought through a solution for a project, I'll go ahead and just look at the definition and see how that can apply to what I'm writing.
So in effect, you're kind of, you're suggesting you find a project and use that to figure out what classes or what parts of the framework you want to use, and then go to town and figure out how to use them yourself. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, that's roughly it. I start with the documentation and see if I can find a way to do it. If I can't find a way to do it through the documentation, just my own searching, because I could be certainly searching under the wrong terminology, then I'll go ahead and try to find a starting point somewhere else and then jump back to the docs.
Just to bring on to a slightly related point there, Mitch, how do you go about searching the documentation itself? Because in my experience, say we're just using Xcode's documentation window, it's all very class-based. Obviously, I mean, filter by class name if you're not doing a, say, full-text search. And it's great if you know the class you're looking for a quick reference. But if I was just looking to do a specific task and wasn't sure what class to use, how would you go about searching for that?
Best guess method. Simply trying to guess what terminology might be there, and the more time I spend in Cocoa, the more I can guess. Okay, this is probably how Apple would do it. Sometimes I'm right, and sometimes I'm wrong, because I certainly don't declare myself an expert. And then, as I said, once I run out of ideas to find the documentation, then I go looking somewhere else and jump back.
Yeah, I was gonna say nobody's mentioned it yet. For some things, the way Apple has links laid out is sometimes a little bit, is really weird. But I find, you know, if you have a tool like, Colin Barrett, recommended, Cocoa Browser Air. And since I, did that, I started using that. Sometimes I don't use it all the time, but I find sometimes if you're, looking around for guides and articles and, about that mention, you know, what to use, and it's really nice to use something like Apkido or Cocoa Browser Air or whatever you find useful, if it helps you find documentation, if it organizes it for you better.
To answer Danny's earlier question about how I go about searching, I usually use the class based browser. So I start typing in the name of a class. Of course, that helps when you know what the class is. I use the full text search a little bit in Xcode's documentation. You can switch it to full text and just start typing in, fetching a remote URL or refreshing a NSRect or something like that. And usually you highlight something in the body, but that's not particularly fast. So I find, you know, Google usually works just as fast or faster for that kind of thing and pulls up a mailing list result or a wiki result or a blog post result or something like that.
I'll extend that, actually. I'll respond back to you, I guess. I found searching the full text in the docs to be not very fruitful too often, basically. I mean, it may be I was just searching for the wrong things. But nowadays, I will jump to Cocoa Builder or other mailing list archives pretty much straight away, actually. If I don't know the class I'm using, or I'm unfamiliar with a certain thing, and I just know a task I want to do, then I will jump to Cocoa Builder or a mailing list.
Yeah, it's good to, you know, have a Gmail account to just, you know, literally have, or to use mail, whatever, you know, just to have all these email archives and sometimes just go through them and browse these topics here. And sometimes I usually do pull up those mailing, some sort of email message pointing to something that will help me out in searching for something I'm interested in.
You see, this was my biggest problem. I think we discussed this earlier about the docs. I think actually finding the way of doing something in the docs is very hard. Once I know that I need this class, or this class might be a good idea, the docs are fine. But discovering that is the class I want, that is where I find, you know, just looking at other people's source code is the way I discover that sort of thing. You know, finding an application that does something similar to what I want. It might not be the same or has a similar concept. You know, finding the code for it, if it's available. When I first started writing Cocoa, you know, I volunteered to a few developers to sort of do some bug fixing for them. Yeah, you know, I was very honest about it, you know, just so I could get sight of their code and spend some time sort of just fixing some very small bugs, but learning loads from experienced Cocoa developers' code bases. And I think that's, because I struggled so much to find the way of going. I mean, you know, I'll be perfectly blunt. The reason I started the Late Night Cocoa podcast is I couldn't find a way to do certain things. I'd opened Xcode about a month earlier. I'd started to work with it. I was so frustrated. There were so few websites at the time that were helping me. I mean, I know there's some great websites out there now, but it was really Scott Stevenson and Cocoa Dev Central. Was sort of, you know, not a lot out there at the time. And so I started a podcast to try and find out information. It was a thinly veiled attempt at getting some free consultancy. But actually just learning from other people's code was a great way of doing it.
Okay. I just like to bring up Cocoa Heads because I think one of the best things, honestly, you can do for yourself in learning Cocoa and even continuing to learn more about Cocoa and all the stuff on Mac OS X is to go to Cocoa Heads meetings, because it's only there that you can really get, you have a bunch of Cocoa experts in one room that are talking to each other, doing presentations or whatever. You know, just go to find a Cocoa Heads near you, or find a, I also do NS Coder Nights, and those are having just, you know, some forum where you're with other Cocoa experts and you're sort of sharing just general advice, or you're sometimes able to just take one person aside, or somebody will come to you and say, you know, what are you trying to learn, and just sit down with you, and you get this nice personal conversation going, and you get you learn the topics just to, personal to you that you're trying to focus on. That's really valuable, and I can't say, you know, enough that, you know, you should find Cocoa Heads or NS Coder Night near you and go to it and just sort of talk to somebody there.
Yeah, I totally agree. And if you haven't got a Cocoa Heads or NS Coder Night near you, then start one. Go back and listen to Mac Developer Roundtable. Well, I don't know, one of the old episodes. It's to do with starting or joining Cocoa Heads groups. So yeah, great tip, Colin.
I'll echo that for Cocoa Heads. I've only been to a couple of the local meetings here in the Boston area, but it's just great to be in the same room of people that are learning the same thing. What I was going to mention are finding, there aren't too many of them, but video-based tutorials work well for the way my brain works. Scotty, I know you've put a couple of those up on your site. I literally just yesterday ran across a new one called Hot Cocoa, and there's a website, iPhoneDevSDK.com, that seems to have started out with some of the non-NDA iPhone development. But as I've been learning the iPhone SDK, some of those snippets in there have been very useful to me.
Yeah, I think people need to do some more screencasts. I seriously meant to do a bunch, and I've only done one so far. I'm planning for this. I'm writing a big Cocoa D-Trace paper right now. I'm planning on trying to do at least one or two for that. And I think that's something that it's a really nice style. It takes a long time to prepare it and get it, you know, processed and then put up online. But once you got it up, it's really solid gold.
Yeah, along those lines, I'd recommend too that you try to blog something that you've learned. I mean, it's a little consolation when you're on day one sitting there staring at Xcode. But once you figure something out, just write a blog post about it, and it forces you to think about it and make sure you really understand it. And you kind of take some of the things you've been internalizing and thinking about in your head and maybe saying out loud in your head and actually putting them on paper or text editor, as it were, and just really understanding it. And sometimes you'll find out, you'll reach something and you realize you didn't do it in your code, but you should probably mention it, but you haven't done it yet. So maybe look it up real quick, and it helps you learn a little more just to have to regurgitate it back out and write it out in a blog post. Maybe regurgitate isn't the right word.
Yeah, that's how I got my start. Cocoa Samurai was honestly just meant to be something that some of my developer thoughts for like a few people locally. I honestly have no idea how I got picked up by Scott Stevenson and then Scotty here. And it's like, you know, my blog's pretty much blown up since then. And, you know, just say your thoughts, you know, as you're developing something, or share, you know, research something and then share it with the world. That's one of the best things you can do.
Okay, we're just going to wrap this conversation up now. We're just going to go through and just pick up maybe a last few tips. Danny, you got anything just to sort of finish off the conversation?
Yeah, I've got a couple of kind of general Xcode tips. It's very important that, I mean, if the better you know your tools, the more productive you're going to be. And a big tip for me is learn the keyboard shortcuts for Xcode, because they will save you a lot of time. And on the same vein, I recommend getting something like Text Expander. I make a lot of use of snippets in my daily work now, and just being able to type three characters and have a frame of a method appear is fantastic.
Okay, great. So that's get to know keyboard shortcuts and Text Expander, very keyboard based. So Justin,
I've got a couple tips. One is pay attention to build warnings. And you can get to this by doing Shift-Command-B, and it's just a window that comes up in Xcode. And you'll see the results of when you're building your project come out there and you get warnings or outright errors. And it's important to pay attention to warnings, because they're often very subtle things, and they might not even affect the way your code runs and goes, but down the road it'll cause a problem. An example would be something's an integer when it should be a pointer, or vice versa, or you use a superclass when you should be using a specific subclass in the framework, and the method you're using it in will complain, but it'll still run, and then down the road, weird things will happen. So should really make it a point of, whenever possible, and not getting in the habit of saying, oh, okay, I know I've got 7 errors when I build, so as long as I don't go up to more than that, it's okay. It's just get it down to 0 and really focus on that, and you'll probably learn a lot along the way. And when you get it down to the letter of kind of the law that Apple lays down, your stuff will work so much better. Another tip I mentioned earlier.
Can I just cut in on that one, Justin? Because sure. I think that one's really, really important, because often as well, if you're using Objective-C, what the compiler considers a warning in lots of other languages would actually be an error. And so if you've come from somewhere else where you're actually used to just dealing with errors and ignoring warnings, which unfortunately lots of programmers do, using Objective-C, you know, that can be a nightmare, because, you know, for example, because of the messaging system, it might only warn you that a method doesn't exist on a class, whereas that might be an error in another environment. And of course, yeah, that's fairly major, that, it's not going, that method caller, that message is not going to work. So yeah, I just want to totally say I agree with that one.
Yeah, that it with Objective-C being such a dynamic language, that is important. That the system might not know something's wrong until down the road when things start to fall into place. So, yeah, definitely. Another quick tip I have is, I mentioned at the beginning, one of the things that was really daunting to me first time I started an Xcode project was the build settings. And so there's two really handy little knobs in there that are useful. One is picking the build config, which is whether you're doing debug or whether you're doing, I forget what they call it now, deployment or release. I think it's release. And then the more important knob in there, though, is defining the scope. And I forget exactly what the label is, but one of the results in the pull-down is build settings defined at this level. And that's determining whether you've tweaked the build setting at the project level or the target level. That if you go in there and stick that onto settings defined at this level, and you can kind of see the things that you've tweaked and kind of remember where you are. And down the road, this is maybe more of an intermediate tip, but if you start getting into complicated tweaks of build settings and compiler settings, you can actually move those out into a separate XC config file. You can kind of manage them in a file if that's geared more to the way you think. You like seeing all the options laid down in a file line by line, instead of tweaking knobs in a GUI and having it all kind of go into one big project file.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Colin?
Well, I just wanted to mention, because Danny brought it up and he sort of forgot to mention it, is I spent 10 hours writing this Xcode shortcuts PDF thing, and it's available for free on cocosamurai.com. And since I published it, it was popular enough, I just decided to license the original document I created in under the Creative Commons. So you have my absolute permission to do whatever you want with it, and you can update it as Xcode shortcuts are updated and so forth. And that's perfectly fine with me. I guess the only other piece of advice for anybody just brand new is just something I said to some people is, you know, just be egotistical enough to think you know everything, but humble enough to know that you still have a lot to learn. So that's generally my attitude towards learning this.
And Brent?
I have one just basic productivity tip, which is that you can bring up the method pop-up menu with a keyboard shortcut. You may have to set it the first time, I don't recall. But once the menu is popped up, it actually responds to type ahead, so you can start typing the name of a menu. The up and down arrow keys work, as well as, you know, command up and command down. So it's very easy to navigate, and it gives you a great, you know, overview of what's in your source file, especially when used in conjunction with pound sign pragma mark, so you can, you know, mark areas. You can see your entire structure and get around really easily.
Okay, well, I hope that was sort of useful. You found some tips in there. It's, I think, one of the things that this conversation has just proven, that it really will depend where you're coming from to where you want to go, as stupid as that sounds. And many of us have had different experiences with Cocoa, but hopefully amongst that lot somewhere you would have picked up an idea or a tip or just something that is going to help you to get into Cocoa if you're just beginning. All right, so we're just going to discuss the news a little bit now, just change the order around. We're doing it at the end this time. So a bunch of iPhone tech talks have just ended from around the world, really. So anyone want to make any comments on them, about anyone who went or anything that happened there, or just anything in general?
Yeah, I actually just got back last week from Seattle. I went to one of the iPhone, I think it was the last ordinarily scheduled iPhone tech talk, although they put tacked another one on in the end in San Jose. I saw Brent up there, so I know he went. It was good. It was great.
I was there?
I think that was you.
Yeah. I was awake for part of it, yeah. I do have to admit, I'm sorry, I'm rudely interrupting you, Justin. There was a moment during an OpenGL talk when apparently I actually started snoring and had Gus Mueller snapping his fingers in my face. Otherwise, it was really fantastic, but OpenGL was
a little rough. Yeah, I heard that was a little dense. It was good, though. It was good talk. I got a lot out of it. You can't really beat the price of free. And although apologies to anybody who wanted to go and couldn't, it was pretty cool. And I had done a Leopard Tech talk, too, a couple years ago in New York. And it was a great... I'm not sure how much we can say about the content. I mean, it was a lot of tips from Apple, obviously. But anybody else go to any of the tech talks?
Yeah, both me and Scotty were at the London one, actually. And it was distinctly different from yours. Yours sounded like it was decent. ours was the one in London was pretty basic. It was for beginners. I learned there was a class called NS String, which was good. A couple of good sessions, but most of the time I spent hanging out with Scotty and Fraser Spears, among others. So it was not much technical content at all. So to hear you guys talk about some crazy OpenGL talk kind of blows my mind a bit.
Yeah, it was kind of... go ahead,
Well, I think some question some people have is the iPhone Tech Talk, sort of the way they were described online, they look very, very similar to the WWDC session. So I guess the burning question for some people want to know is, are they very similar to the WWDC sessions? I haven't been to the iPhone talks, but I've been to the WWDC sessions. Are they the same, the similar, or what?
I think the problem with the, I wasn't at the US ones, obviously, but maybe the London one is, you know, those sessions are perfectly valid, for the people who need them. And I just think Apple needs to be a little clearer about the content and the level that the talks are going to be, because, when a session starts with the words, "This is Xcode," you know you're in for a long morning. As I think one of the tweets said in the session I was in. And that's fine, because there are going to be people out there who need that session. But when it's just defined as, you know, come and get some great pro iPhone training or iPhone days, you know, I think there needs to be a little bit more about you know, what level
I'm in absolute agreement there. At the end of the day, they had these massive applications, which would have said on them who we were and how many, you know, how that we developed for the Mac and all that, in which case, why were we, you know, there? It was clearly not meant for us. There were a few people there who developed apps for the iPhone before, but a lot of it, I mean, it would have been great if I hadn't developed on the Mac before, or I was coming from Windows or something. I mean, I think I saw a few ThinkPads there, which was slightly disturbing, but it was essentially pretty much useless if you'd done any iPhone development before or much Mac development.
For me, the most valuable part is not necessarily really the session so much as the inspiration that I get from, especially, I can't say, I'm not sure how much I can talk about the specifics, but early-ish in the tech talk, they talk about, you know, what makes for a great iPhone app and give some examples and talk about, you know, why these are great. And, you know, just seeing those and hearing the talk about them, you know, is a reminder that there's great work being done, and it just takes, you know, going beyond, you know, the easy or the halfway there to, you know, keep pushing, keep trying, keep designing, you know, to take your stuff to the next level. And that's just a good reminder that you need now and again, and it's delivered very powerfully in an experience like the iPhone Tech Talk.
Yeah, I'll second that. I thought that was neat for two reasons. One, that they were giving a lot of inspiration and kind of Apple saying, here's what we idolize in an application. And on the flip side of that, these were ordinary developers, some of them in the room. And so it highlighted the kind of the opportunity there. If it's something that Apple really likes, they'll run with it and start showing it to everybody and really give you some free press. So that was kind of cool. Going back to the levels, I guess, yeah, and to a certain extent, I was kind of stuck between two tracks. There were kind of three tracks. The big one was this general, here's Xcode, here's instruments, here's interface builder. And that kind of took place, and it was designed for the most number of people. So these are people who aren't developing on the Mac already, for example. Then there's kind of a middle of the road track, and then there was a kind of a miscellaneous, which was part web technologies and part IT and enterprise. And I felt kind of between some of the beginning stuff and then some of, say, positional audio and OpenGL, which was a little dense. So, yeah, I mean, I think Apple's really playing to the platform and getting people over on the platform from other platforms. And so that was kind of the real focus. And I kind of went into it with that in mind. And the other part I really enjoy about these tech talks is just meeting up with other developers, meeting new people or seeing people who I already know and hanging out a bit and getting some free food from Apple. So all in all, it was a net win.
Okay. I guess the other news that has come out just before we record this, and will obviously be old news by the time people listen to this, is Macworld and Apple's announcement that Steve isn't doing the keynote this year, and that this is going to be their last one. Anybody want to comment on that?
I'm just a little bit saddened by that. I guess I can understand, like, it sounds like Apple has been basically planning this for a while, but I don't. When I first came to the Mac, I mean, I listened to one of Steve Jobs' keynotes at Macworld, and that was where I got my start transitioning into the Mac. And I don't know, it feels a little bit sad to hear that happen. But I guess for me, WWDC is basically taking over as the event to go to and where I get most of my information from these days. But I don't know. I'm just a little conflicted.
Well, I guess I'll never see a Macworld keynote, but I guess you can kind of, it makes sense in the Apple needs to get away from the fact that their products are limited to launching events fixed in time. I mean, they've clearly started these special events and it's worked for the iPods and they've done it with the MacBooks now, and that's clearly where they're going with product launches. So I'd imagine we won't see a big keynote in terms of products in WWDC anymore, which will rock because we'll hopefully get some nice developer keynotes. Well, you know, more. But the thing for me is how Macworld will actually, go after this, because looking at where Apple has stopped giving keynotes or stopped attending and presenting at these expos, Apple Expo just got cancelled. I was there this year, and it was, well, it wasn't great, to be honest. And that Steve Jobs used to do a keynote there. I don't think Mac will necessarily die or too quickly, but it'll be interesting. Interesting to see how Macworld takes this hit in terms of attendance and who's presenting.
It's sad, but I expected this to happen several years ago. As I mentioned, I'm in the Boston area, so I saw the last East Coast Macworld go down the drain once Apple refused to show up. And chances are the same thing will happen in San Francisco. It might take another year or two, since that's near a lot of the technology hub of a lot of the companies that do exhibit. I've always been confused about the timing of Macworld, especially the San Francisco show. Once Apple got so embedded in the consumer space, it made more sense for them to have an expo to do launches in probably late summer, early fall, when they could introduce things for the holiday season. Just after that makes no sense at all. I think it makes perfectly good sense for Apple in the short term. About 45,000 people go to Macworld San Francisco now, which is a lot of people, but they all own Macs. Nobody's going there to say, gee, I wonder if I should buy a Mac. So Apple's spending all of that time and effort and money to really just keep customers that are pretty dedicated anyway. My concern is the effect for the smaller software publishers and smaller developers that ride on Apple's coattails to an extent by being at the same show in their small booths, and customers who have never heard of that particular company wander by, and then they get some business and get some exposure. And I think over the long term, chances are Macworld will cease to exist or at least fade into something that is very far from where it is now.
Well, I see it as an opportunity for us. I mean, everyone there already does have a Mac, right? So Apple is almost a waste of time for them. All the other people there who have software and other hardware to sell to people who already have Macs are the people who really can benefit from a great Macworld Expo. And so I wonder, with Apple not being there, does that mean our new releases and so on won't be drowned out by the news of the keynote? I mean, right now, if you were to come out with a new product, that week, well, nobody cares, even if it's fantastic, because they're going to be talking about what Apple's talking about. But without Apple, we have some kind of a space that maybe can be filled up by a whole bunch of different software and hardware developers.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, at Macworld, what, about 4,000 of the 45,000 people get into the keynotes? As you said, almost everyone already owns a Mac. I've never been to Macworld, but as far as I understand, the Mac booth is not really a lot different to an Apple store, which is just around the corner. At about the same time, if they release new products, they go into the store the same time anyway. So in theory, it shouldn't make any difference, because it's a gathering of Mac people to talk about Mac stuff. And the fact that there's no new Mac announcement that day shouldn't change things. In reality, will it? I don't know. But we'll have to wait and see. I think Macworld is somewhere I'd like to go. I think it's a place where there's a bit of a buzz. It's part of the Mac community, and it will be sad to see it go. But trade shows are dropping like flies, so it's going to be interesting to see over the next year or two what happens. Okay, that's the news, I think, wrapped up, unless anyone's got anything really stunningly interesting that they've heard this last couple of weeks. Well, there we are. That answers that question. So we're going to go on to our tips. Website or an application or a blog or anything that just want to recommend to the Mac developer community. Let's start with you, Danny. Got your tip for this episode?
I do now. I've recently started reading another Cocoa Technical blog, which I'm probably sure everyone else has heard of, and I just caught on to it, called Cocoa with Love. And I'm actually really enjoying it. There's been some great posts on there. I think that's the URL. I'm hideously brilliantly prepared as he types it into Google. Yeah, CocoaWithLove.com. And it's been picked already on MDR. So there you go. I don't have a pick. But it's a great blog.
Justin.
Yeah, I'm going to plug a desktop tool that I just started using recently called Cornerstone. It's for Subversion. It's kind of a Subversion GUI for the desktop. And I really love it. I mean, I've been using Subversion for years and I've administered repositories, so I'm kind of no stranger to doing it all via the command line. But this just really makes it easy for me to see what's changed in a working copy. I like viewing diffs in TextMate and not in like a diffing application like File Merge. So I just like seeing the plus signs and the minus signs and seeing what's going on. So I don't know if this is particularly useful to people new to Coco, but if you're new to Subversion, this might work for you. I think it's at zenaware.com, ZENNAWARE.com, something like that. But it's called Cornerstone, one word, and it's a really great application. That's my plug.
Great. Thanks, Justin. Colin?
Well, I'll do two little small things, I guess. My first thing is just it's an unusual pick, but I think it's really good for anybody, any independent Mac software developer who's like planning on selling things. And it's a book called Predictably Irrational by Dan Arley. And it's a very interesting read because it's all about how consumers make decisions about what prices for various things, whether it's software or books or, you know, whatever product they're looking at is really worth it. It's just a really, it was recommended on Dignation. I've fallen in love with it ever since I started reading it. I guess my other thing is, everybody else, you know, Marcus Zarras, Core Data, Bill Dudney, I think, has a Core Animation. So I recommend Dtrace is a really great developer tool to help you understand what's going on in your application, your system.
Thank you, Colin. Mitch.
Hi, I was just trying to find the URL for the Hot Cocoa video podcast I mentioned earlier, and I haven't found it yet, but it's searchable on the iTunes site. I mention it only because it seems to be pretty good. I don't know the person who puts it together, but he makes mistakes and records those mistakes and then goes back and corrects them, and I found that kind of fascinating. So that would be my recommendation, the Hot Cocoa video podcast on the iTunes store.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And last but no means least, Brent.
Lately, I've been having to do mock-ups and prototypes and little bits of graphics work. And I don't really have the patience to launch Photoshop, so I've been using an app called Acorn, which I think is just fantastic. It's for any developer who needs to do just a little bit of stuff, it's really, really cool.
Okay, so Gus is going to feel like he's getting good value today because my pick was going to be Voodoo Pad. just come out as Voodoo Pad 4. It for just keeping notes, keeping your ideas, linking things together, just letting things splurge out. It's just a great application. You know, text editor with linking and it's hard to describe. You just got to give it a go. So that's Voodoo Pad. That's from Flying Meat Software, as was Acorn. And honestly, Gus didn't pay us anything. Well, he didn't pay me anything. He might have paid Brent something, I guess. So there we are. Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's time to do our wrap-up. It's time for you to tell the world where they can find you, tell the world where they can hear your musings and all your opinions and taste your wares, as they say. So let's go back to Danny. Mr. Greg, tell
I'm
us all
Danny
about yourself.
Danny Greg. You could probably find my blog is at dannygreg.com, at dannygreg.com. Haven't posted there for a while, but I do have a post coming up, which should be interesting. I work for Real Mac Software, which is realmacsoftware.com. We just released Little Snapper 1.0 and 1.0.1, very close together, which I've been working pretty mentally on, and I really like, so hopefully I've heard good things, so hopefully you guys find uses for it. And we also make Rapid Weaver, which is an all-encompassing web tool to create websites. There you go.
Thank you, Danny. Justin?
Sure. My shop is Code Sorcery Workshop, and that's at codesorcery.net. S-O-R-C, not S-O-U-R-C. I always point that out. I have two products right now. One is called Pukka, which is a bookmark application for Delicious and Magnolia and similar services that works with your browser and works with NetNewsWire and your RSS reader. And the other application I have is called Meerkat, and that's for managing SSH tunnels. And it's most useful for web developers and sysadmins, but really you can use it for iTunes music collections and all kinds of stuff, screen sharing. I also do a lot of freelance and contracting work, both in Cocoa on the Mac and the iPhone, and also web development, mostly in Drupal, which I mentioned before in a previous podcast. But I put a lot of code snippets up there, and I also am working slowly but surely on some Drupal-based tools for Mac developers, for stores and license management and things like that, that who knows when it'll ever get out there, but that's on my big old list of stuff to do. So keep an eye out for that.
Thank you very much. And Colin?
I'm Colin Wheeler. I run CocoSamurai.com. I'm hoping to very soon, definitely by the time this comes out, to have a big Coco D-Trace paper and some screencasts come out. So hopefully that'll be good for some people here.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Colin. Look forward to those as well. Mitch?
My name is Mitch Cohen. I actually have nothing to sell today. I do have my company's website is proactiveinteractive.com. I maintain a blog at mitchcohen.com, M-I-T-C-H-C-O-H-E-N. And where I muse about some programming things and other things Macintosh and occasionally things political. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mitch Cohen.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Brent.
My name is Brent Simmons. I work for NewsGator on an RSS reader, NetNewsWire for Mac and iPhone. My weblog is at inessential.com, where I try to portray myself as an intelligent, reasonable human being.
Enough said. My name is Scotty. I run the Mac Developer Network, and that's at www.macdevelopernetwork.com. This has been the Mac Developer Roundtable. Thanks for listening. Until next time, you take care. Okay, well, if you listen to any of the other Mac Developer Network podcasts, you may have picked up there have been some changes at MDN. So I'm just going to play you an announcement that has gone out on some of the other feeds. Hi, I'm Scotty from the Mac Developer Network. Can you believe it's been almost 2 years since I produced the very first episode of Late Night Coco as a complete Coco noob and a complete ignoramus who didn't have a clue what I was doing? Since then, I've produced over 70 podcasts and screencasts, and it's been great fun and met a lot of great people, but it's also been a lot of hard work. As you might be aware, in 2008, I took the step of investing far more time into the Mac Developer Network in order to provide additional benefit to Mac developers. As part of this process, I also introduced MDM membership in the hope that developers would look to support MDM in its contribution to the community. Unfortunately, this has not been really very successful, and I now find myself in a very difficult position and having to make some serious decisions regarding the future of MDN. This is something that's very close to my heart. It's very personal, and you know, after a lot of consideration, I've decided I've got two choices. I either close MDM down and return to life as a normal developer in order to feed my family, or I've got to take the bull by the horns and make MDM produce enough income to justify the number of hours it consumes of my life. My preferred option is not to see MDM die. I hope I'm not being selfish in thinking that way. But in order to do that, I'm going to have to go from a place where the majority of the content is free with a few extras for members to where the majority of content is for members with a few extra freebies on the top of that. So, what does this mean in reality? Well, from now on, the content on MDM will fall into one of two categories. It'll either be free content, which will be just that, free, or it'll be premium content. Premium content will be free to MDM members, they'll be able to access all of that. Equally, premium content will be available for sale, so if you don't want to become an MDM member, but you just want to buy a particular episode of a podcast or a particular training course, you can buy it. So, premium content,
free to members, available for purchase to non-members. So, what is free? What costs you money? Okay, let's start with free content. Mac Developer Roundtable, Xcode Quick Tip Screencast, for which there are a whole bunch of new episodes planned, and moving from members only to free content will be the Developer Lives podcast, the podcast that looks at the background and the history of some of the best Mac developers. That's now going to be a free podcast for available for anybody. Okay, premium content, Late Night Coco, Mac Software Business Podcast, and the MDN video training courses. Now, I'm not saying every episode of Late Night Coco will be premium or every episode of the Mac SP podcast is going to be a premium content, but you should expect that the majority will be. The majority of the back catalogue is going to remain free. One or two episodes have gone to premium, but the majority of the back catalogue from this moment is free. Now, if you wish to join MDN, $49 for 1 year, you continue to get all the stuff for free. You can get some to the members' feeds. You'll get everything. If you don't wish to join MDN, just stay subscribed to the free feeds as they currently are in iTunes. And every time an episode is released, a small promo for the episode will be released on the feed and it will tell you all about it. And you'll be able to go to the website and just buy that individual episode if you don't want to become a full member. An episode of Late Night Coco or the Mac Software Business Podcast is going to be $1.99, $1.99 for an episode if you want to buy it individually. The training courses will vary. Now, please note, members, training courses are now free. You don't have to pay for training courses at all. They're not half price anymore. They're free if you're an MDM member. Okay, I hope that all makes sense. I know many people are going to be disappointed. Some people might even be angry. But this really is a choice between make this work for me, as selfish as that might be, or just let the whole thing go because, you know, my personal situation at the moment does not allow me to spend this amount of time for no income to produce this stuff. But, you know, it will just not be a good thing for me to do for my family. So, thank you for those who are already members and support. Your membership is just transferred across. Everything I've just said counts for you. If you want to start picking up all of the premium content, you will need to go and change the feed you subscribe to. If you go to the Mac Developer Network website, log in, there's a members area, there's a page, podcast feeds, which will give you all the feeds for members, and you'll be able to get everything and just pick it up like you were doing before. Thank you very much, everyone, for your support. I've spoken to a lot of the developers who've appeared on the podcast while making this decision, and the support I have from them has been phenomenal. I just really want to thank the Mac community for the way I've been accepted in the last 2 years. And I hope that you will at least understand the moves I'm having to make here, even if you don't want to support them. There are already members-only episodes starting to appear on the members' feeds. The promos for those episodes will begin to appear on these feeds in the next few days. I just need to give it a few days gap to make sure that everyone's had the opportunity to download this announcement, because iTunes only tends to download the last episode when it gets to a feed. So I need to give it a few days to make sure the majority of people get to pick this up. And then the promos for the members' episodes will start hitting the feeds. Okay. That's it for now. Until we speak again, take care.
Sorry, Mitch, I can't remember if you said you wanted to add anything, or are you...
No, I'm completely clueless, thank you.
Okay, that's good. There's a line I can edit in. There's a line I can edit in somewhere.
have you listened to it full? Because he does put outtakes on here.
You could replace his intro with that.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thanks.
And the deal is done.
Was I boring you that much, Mitch?
Hey, kids, sorry about that. There's a blizzard outside, but I wish I could blame that on the power.
I know I was waffling, but there we are. Okay, if anybody's still got the will to live after my answer, someone pick up something else.
Who's got a topic?
Anyone want to respond to anything that anybody else said? No.
You're all wrong.
All generalizations are false.
No, no, exactly. That's not true at all. That's never true.
I concur. In fact, I second. Just go, give it to Justin. Justin's way too good at this.
Justin, you ever felt like running a developer network? you'd be really good at it. unlike the current incumbent.
I didn't do a two-hour one before this, though, so you can't give me too much credit.
Oh, dear.
He's modest, too. Quickly, Scotty.
And he's cheap. What more could you want?
It helps that it's early afternoon for me, too. So.
Yeah. And now I've bored you. Every time I speak, I bore people. How do I stay in this job for this long? That's it. Should we just all give up and go home now?
Pub.
Anybody else
What's
got anything
podcast
actually
about
interesting
anyway?
To say?
That was good.
Anyone think we should? We listen for your accent, actually. It's just the sound of your voice. I mean, we want you to keep talking. We're not going to talk. You keep going. We're good.
Not only does he want my job, he's now coming on to me.
I'm pretty sure that was Brent, though.
Yep.